this at all.
Yeah, pick a button, any button.
I feel like I'm in a radio shack here.
Hi, Marshall Fox, good afternoon. In dramatizing a work of nonfiction, what is the filmmaker's obligation to the truth?
You said dramatizing the work of nonfiction?
Yes.
Well, if the obligation is to try to tell the story as best you can, the filmmaker is the interpreter in this particular case of Mr. Barrett's very fine book, and so I try to tell the same story or get the same thing across, sometimes if you try to do it in a visual way with the tools you have, which is to show the particular visuals, at least the way I interpret them. Everything, when you read a piece of material, you visualize it in your mind, and that's the way it is now. Several people may visualize it differently, but you have to kind of go with the one that you feel it is. Unless it's in some cases, in this particular project, it was easy because the locations are pointed out to you by the author, and others it's not. Sometimes there's things that don't exist anymore, such as nightclubs, what have you.
There are some people who might be surprised that you take this on as your next directing assignment. It might not be the kind of movie we'd expect you to choose. In fact, even the script writer who originally sent you the script just to get your opinion didn't really expect that you'd come back and say this might be a movie that I'd want to direct. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose it and that feeling that some people may have that it's...
I just like I like his screenplay. He gave me the screenplay. I hadn't read John Barron's book at that time, and I couldn't understand why the studio hadn't made a move to make this into a film. And I went back and I read the book, and I told the studio that I thought that this would make an interesting film, and if they didn't have anybody assigned or thinking about it, I said I'd like to take the project and run with it, and that's the way I came about getting involved. But as far as whether why it's my project or why I was on it as opposed to some of the things I've done in the past, I guess I'm at that stage in life. I don't want to repeat myself. I'd like to do different projects. I don't see any reason. Storytelling is storytelling. Whether you're telling it in what, no matter what period or what have you, I just feel it was interesting storytelling. I'd like to be involved with it.
But what did you see in the book that you thought this would make a good movie? What was it in that story?
Well, it's nice to be in this day and age when we're raised with a lot of quick images on MTV and what have you, or sometimes stories that are totally subservient to some special effects or some other gimmick to propel them forward. I felt it was nice to go back to old-fashioned storytelling where you deal with characters and deal with the different problems with characters. In this particular case, John Barron's characters were very, he showed a quirkiness to Savannah that I think grabbed everybody's curiosity, at least by the popularity of the book. He seems to have made everybody very curious about Savannah. I'm sure almost any city in the world has its an interesting side to it, if you can just delve in there and find out what it is. But in this particular case, Savannah seemed very unusual and almost a little bit isolated from some other parts of the region there. And it just became very provocative.
All of your actors describe you as an incredibly kind, giving, patient director. Is that style born of years of being in the business and seeing how not to do it in terms of sort of building your own perfect director in your mind and then saying that to your actors, right?
I don't consciously, I haven't thought about it, but I think that that's probably it. I think coming from the acting side of it and working with directors who were both very sympathetic to work with, and some of them that were, who didn't pay attention to the acting part as much. They just let the actors, you know, say the words and get on the hell out of here, and we'll get on with the camera moves and angles. When you work with those kind, you kind of learn what you want to do and what you don't want to do over the years. And I always feel that acting is a very it's a strange profession, because it's the adage of every actor thinks that every job is his last job is not really a falsehood. That's the truth, and it's a very insecure thing. So to make actors secure, you can get a performance out of them much easier, and I felt it was important to. I think that's where I've come from. I find that I try to be interested in all the elements of filmmaking, but the acting has my greatest
sympathy.
Why didn't you act in this one? Probably because I didn't think I was as good a casting show.
Gentlemen
of the flesh. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, a friend of mine the other day who is about my age said, you know, there's one great thing about being in your 60s. What can they do to you? And there's a point there. You know, at some point it's like you've had good things said about you, and you've had bad things said about you, and so that's at some point you can become very philosophical, and you say that's the individual opinion. That's what life's all about, and that's fine.
Michael.
Even the people who say something good about you might be wrong, so you never know.
Was there any point where you considered casting yourself in this movie?
This may further, I didn't really think that I was particularly right for the role. I might have attempted to try one of them, but I thought the. I think the cast, I enjoyed very much the cast that I had in the film. I don't think I would have been as good.
As you grow older, does this film take on kind of a certain urgency that, you know, you may do another 6 films, 10 films? Is it that much more important to you, given that whatever?
Don't cut me too short. it doesn't, there's no urgency at all. In fact, I use less urgency, I think. I think as you mature, you find less urgency to do material back to back. I just feel that they come along. I'm trying to enjoy the old smell of roses. And you just try to take a little more time in between, look a little more carefully, and do things differently. When I was back in the 70s, I did sequel movies, and in the 60s, I did movies and sequels, and I did all kinds of stuff, and I was working back to back. But sometimes at the expense of personal life and what have you. So, but now you get to a certain point, and you think, yeah, let's spend time on this project, and then go on to the next when its time arrives, not his schedule.
As a father, what was it like directing love scenes with his daughter?
It's fine. You treat everybody just like the actor that they are. Everybody is very professional and comes ready to work. So.
But we heard that one love scene was cut from the movie. It wound up on the floor.
Well, there was a lot of things that were cut from the movie. In order to really tell Mr. Rennert's book and John Lee Hancock's screenplay, the only way to do the whole thing, I would have had to have about 4 hours worth of film, and I didn't think you'd all stay for that. So I had to just cut certain things, and just, everybody worth it a little bit.
But was that uncomfortable at all, directing a love scene with your daughter?
No. It's nice to be there to chaperone.
John Cusack said you only did it in one take, though.
Yeah. That's part of the chaperone.
Okay, you sound like you've got a very eclectic group on the soundtrack, including you and your daughter and Kevin. Your daughter said that we asked her how you sounded, and she said you had a lot of fun. Now, how did you get this group together on the soundtrack?
Matt Pearson, who was a producer of the soundtrack, he gathered most of the people together. He and I discussed quite a bit, and then at the last minute he said, why don't you do something? And I said, fine, but I'm not using it in the movie. And that's all right, I wanted to do something. And so we did it. It was fun. We were in the Johnny Mercer mood, so everybody got into it.
But how
has
being a father again changed your outlook on life? Are you changing
that for the school? Yeah, I think being a father again is great. I have a friend who says you should always have a five-year-old around the house. But that's, I think he's talking about keeping a certain vitality and keeping young. I enjoy it myself. Thank you very much. And do I change diapers? Yeah, I do that.
And how being a husband is right?
It's good. This is the second and last time.
Why did you become a husband again after all this time of not becoming one?
Because I found the woman I was nuts about.
How'd you know?
I don't know. I guess it was one of those deals that you just it kind of comes upon you. I liked her. I thought she just had all the qualities that I, you know, who knows what happened.
Joe?
Okay. In a few weeks, we've got the idea is coming out on Laser Disc, something like 15 minutes has never been in America released. And I understand the original cut of this film was, what, 3.5, 3 to 3/4 hours. So I'm assuming there's going to be a time when we can see a more, a longer version of this film on Laser Disc or something. How do you feel about this as a filmmaker, the idea that we can be entering an age where there's no longer a definitive version of the film? And every 2 years, you make the on Laser Disc, you make the movie, a longer version, a different version, a different director's cut.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that was probably born out of the studio system, Joe, where guys had the film taken away from them, and a certain amount of the film has been removed, and then they decided, well, we'll come back and get the director's cut. Well, this is the director's cut here. This is what I ended up with in the balance of everything, trying to balance it out, of trying to show what John had in the book, the quirkiness, and also. And then not make it a trial movie. And there's a lot of difficulties in translating a book like this to the screen because of a certain time constraints. And maybe a certain city has oriented people may really like to see every bit of everything that was shot. But at some point, you have to make a decision to say, this is the film and this is the way it is. So I probably wouldn't be prone to going back and adding some. Who knows how I feel 4 or 5 years from now? One can never say, but as of now, I just say this is it.
Gentlemen in the green shirt over here, please.
When you look back at the 60s, what do you think has changed for good, and what do you think has changed for bad in the movie industry?
In the
60s?
Yeah. From the 60s now until now? I don't know, because I was looking at it from a different vantage point than the younger person trying to put out, you know, putting out a lot of material and what have you. There's a lot of advantages you're making movies today for a filmmaker in the sense that you can you have a lot more freedom if you have a certain if you have a reputation of some sort. But at the same token, there was something to be said beyond the 60s, but back into the 40s, 50s, when the studios knew a little bit more. I think in the old days, people were more apt to say, well, if we're going to have brain surgery, we'll hire a brain surgeon. Nowadays, sometimes, you know, a person doesn't have to have much experience and will do a film or whatever, and sometimes it comes out good, sometimes not so. But I don't know, movie making has always been sort of a strange profession as far as there's a lot of real hardworking intelligent people in there, and there's also a lot of fakery, and somewhere among all of that the resume has hopefully the good stuff will rise with time.
I'll speak with Savannah is a distinctive character in the novel and in the movie. And I wonder, you obviously spotted that right off the bat, and how you went about getting Savannah as a character into the film.
Well, I tried to talk to a lot of the people that, who were characters out of John's book. Tried to go meet the characters. When you go to the places, they sort of take on a life of their own. You talk to the various people who knew people or and some of them who were still around. For instance, the guy with the flies, you know, that was tied to the string, John Barrett, had brought him on the set one day, and I got to meet him, and he no longer does that, but we all change. But he did do that at one time, and you know, that's kind of little oddities. What makes this book so unique is that you have all these characters. And a lot of people in Georgia, a lot of people in Atlanta and other cities think of Savannah as like another world. There is something, once you're there, John can explain this a lot more than I can, but once you're there, there's a whole other world in this, which is kind of crazy. But at the same time, the same token, it has there's a certain tolerance about other people and other people's lifestyles that make it interesting too. I mean, it's an interesting statement in today's world.
John, do you think Clint captured that world the way you saw it in the book?
Yeah, I think he did. I saw the movie for the first time last night, and I was thrilled. I was delighted. Yes, I could feel it all over again. And also, I might add that Lady Shibley, you see her exactly as she is. Clint really caught her. I said to Clint, you know, when my book came out, I said to Shibley, all you've got to do is continue being yourself. And I said to Clint, that's what I had told Shibley. And Clint said, that's the way I see it. I'm going to try to get her to be herself, and I think I know how to do it. At that point, I left the scene because I didn't want to be too present, and he brought her out perfectly. He also, and I must say, captured Savannah. That was your question. He did.
How did you get along with Lady Shibley?
Oh, fabulous.
Also, what do you think really happened that night?
I don't know what happened. I'll go from back to front. I don't know what really happened. But what I've expressed here is what I think the answer is. Is that nobody will ever know. I think it's stated that in the book nobody will really. And everybody speculates. I've talked to the lead detectives who were on the scene at the particular time, and I've talked to friends of Jim Williams and everything else. It seems like a lot of things. It could have been a contrived thing, and it could have been a self-defense. Obviously, I think the police department, they feel that that the key to the shooting was the fact that Billy Hanson character put out the cigarette in on the guy's favorite desk and sort of trashed things around a little bit. But who really knows? Nobody will ever know the thing. And I think John, I think the book kind of expresses that. John does take an opinion in the book, and I think the opinion is expressed here in a Rashomon-esque kind of try to, is like, I think Kevin is equally convincing when he tells both stories, and so it's up for the audience to kind of come to their own conclusions on that. And whether it has anything to do with other trials, I don't know. Other trials are sensationalized at the moment, and I don't think there's any bearing. I don't think it'll have any bearing one way or the other. Maybe some people might compare it, like in the the evidence and the tampering with evidence, or trying to cast the police in a way as shoddy police work and stuff. That might be compared to some of the way the defense tried to handle the O.J. Case, and that's about the only comparison I see.
Are you proud of your daughter's acting career?
Oh, very much so. She was in a movie called Tightrope with me when she was 11 years old, 10 years old, I can't remember what.
She did 12.
But she said 12?
Yes.
Oh, maybe it was. She probably has a better memory than me. But she's she was very good in that picture. I'm not as proud as I missed it.
She said she didn't. She auditioned for this picture just like everyone else.
Yeah, no, I made her audition. I when I did Tightrope some years ago, I thought at the time, I said, well, Allison could be in it, but I had always had a nagging feeling about it. I said, what happens if your daughter wasn't good in the picture? You had to fire her. How could that, what effect would that have on a child growing up? And or father-daughter relationship, what have you. But she turned out she was excellent in that movie, and I felt she'd be good in this one. But I wanted to make sure she went through the ropes on this one. Me? No, I just enjoy films. I enjoy films. I enjoy seeing films. I enjoy making films. I think there's nothing to prove in any of it. It's just storytelling and the joy of the storytelling. I think that's all there is to prove.
You Mr. Eastwood, no. Not long ago you were quoted as saying something to the effect of 5 years ago I would never have imagined that I would make a movie about a drag queen. Has something about you changed perhaps that makes cross-dressing your homosexuality a more comfortable topic for you to deal with in the movies?
You mean? Am I wearing my gloves? I don't know. I always I've always considered myself very tolerant of other people's lifestyles, and I think this story has that message a little bit. It's also fun to tell stories about things that you don't understand, or you don't feel, or people that don't have your feelings. And you do any movie, or you do a picture about a villain or something, you might not have the same feeling for that person, but it's more interesting to watch a performer conjure up all that. And I just like a variety of storytelling. This appealed to me at the time, I think, based upon, as I said earlier, John's very, very colorful descriptions and book, and the individuality. And I've done a lot of stories about individuals and individuality, and this is something about the kind of people in Savannah that do their own thing, whether it's wearing flies or whether it's being a drag queen or whatever you want to do. And I've made that statement in movies along the way, and Bronco Billy, I think, his most picture I did some years ago, most famous statement in there was, I am who I want to be. So, and like Chablis is who she wants to be, and everybody is who they want to be. And that's kind of fun to tell a story like that.
How will Savannah react to this movie, and will you be there for the spring on November 20th to get the first-hand reaction?
I don't know because of obligations here and out west whether I'll be there or not. I'd like to be there. I hope they would react very favorably. Certainly, I think it's photographed well. I think Savannah, in the majority anyway, have been very taken with John's book from the very beginning, and it's brought a great deal of attention to the city. Some of the people maybe not so pleased about it, and others, I think, very pleased about it. So it's all going to be an individual thing.
That raises the question of translating the book to the screen, because so many people love this book so much. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about the reaction of the followers of the book, that they will say, oh, well, you know, it's not quite what we read?
Well, the ultimate person to be a follower of, to please in that thing would be this gentleman to my left, and if he seems to think the movie is okay, then that's fine by me. He's the nucleus of all this.
A lot of people seem to be surprised you do a movie that has like the escape things and things like this. Do you think your social and political views have been accurately portrayed by the media on topics like this? Or?
I don't know how they've been portrayed by the media. Probably not. I don't think my social views have ever been portrayed by the media statement. If they have, they've been kind of guessed upon. I don't mind any kind of theme. I like various themes. There's various movies. Every movie has its own story, and every book is its own story. And I like reading all kinds of material. I grew up liking all kinds of movies from heavy dramas to soap operatic to Abbott and Costello, or you name it. There's no reason why you can't have a variety in life as far as personal work as the variety of entertainment you might have enjoyed in your whole upbringing.
The lady in the
third
row, please.
Hi. You mentioned that you had started your career at a different time in Hollywood. Were you always encouraging your daughter to be an actress, or was there any apprehension?
There's always apprehension when somebody says they want to become an actor, because it's a very, very difficult profession, and a lot of people want to be in it, and that's exactly what I told her. I said, if you want to do this, you got to remember that a lot of people want to do this, and you have to work that much harder. You have to work. It's not any pushover. It's the same as in almost any profession. That is the harder you work, maybe the more you gain out of it, but there's a lot of other factors too, luck and fate, whatever comes. But if you want it, you want it bad enough to stay in that.
Betsy in the back. Hi, you have a number of Canadians in smaller roles in the show, playing people other than themselves, but Lady Chablis is always the main Canadian playing herself, you know, in the film. And I wondered if it was difficult, even though she is a performer, to get the kind of film performance out of her. Were there special things you had to do to kind of get her into film sticking as opposed to showmanship?
She has the good fortune to play, you know, to be actually sort of living out what she does all the time anyway. She lives this character, and so the big trick is to do drag in a movie is very, very difficult, because actors tend to, when they get a role like that, they tend to take the bit in their mouth and just go crazy and start running down the road with the writer. But it kind of came effortlessly for her. Because she's performed this all the time, and I just tried to encourage her, like John was mentioning earlier, try to just to be herself. A lot of this dialogue that is we're working with is stuff that was inspired by you in the first place. So just say, and I must give John Cusack a lot of credit because he was very, very improvisational, and I encouraged him to improvise a lot, whether to just keep the banter going. She, Chablis is at her very best when you you have the objective of the scene in mind, but you are just kind of moving. You just kind of let her go free. She has to kind of soar free. It's very much like when you were talking musically a few minutes ago. Things are going on over top of that. You know, it's like a jazz musician or something. If you're playing Skylark or something, your interpretation becomes interpretive after a while. It leaves the melody. And so you have to not be afraid to leave the melody and then come back to it, completing the statement of the song. But you have to be able to allow her to do that, and that's when you get the best work out of that particular performance.
Was she ever a prima donna?
Who?
Was she ever a prima donna?
No, she was very anxious to play the part and wanted to do it.
What's your perspective on the current climate surrounding quote unquote violent films and sort of decrying them as the part of the reason the downfall of our civilization and so forth, in terms of you certainly had a history of those types of stuff?
Yeah, well, sometimes I look back on it and mind they weren't that violent by today's standards, but I guess, I think as you get. As you go along in life, if you see a good violent film, a film that is really told well and has an interesting thing to say and has some violence, it's fine. But all the bad ones, I think, make it bad for everyone else. The same with bad comedies or whatever. And violence is something that I've grown away from in recent years. And I remember when we were doing Unforgiven, Gene Hackman mentioned that he wasn't interested in doing violent films, and I said, well, I know how you feel, but I think we can make a statement in that particular project about violence, not only in life, but in film as well. So, and then he came around to thinking that was a good idea. And so, you know, now I hate to do it, you know, later on in Line of Fire, a lot of these pictures I've been involved with, they have maybe an action sequence, a little bit, but they're not just wall to wall, and that's I just to do a mayhem movie. It doesn't feel to me much anymore.
Is that because you're older, perhaps your age?
Probably.
A lot of your older movies don't really leave much doubt to what it's supposed to be living for. You think that's why you've embraced more on this really more recently, but it comes like this in Perfect World.
I don't think there's any reason for the ambiguity. I think it's just kind of come about. Even some of the older ones, like the High Plains Drifter, dating back in the early 70s, I still left ambiguous endings and things like that to try to and try to make. I never tried to make the good guy also good. I sometimes made the bad guy pretty bad, like I guess in Dirty Harry, when we did the bad guy was pretty bad, but I tried not to make the hero Dirty Harry as a conventional good guy by movie standards. He was a guy who had certain things to overcome within his own persona.
Double
question.
Do you have a next film, and can you comment on on the Turner special that they're doing on you?
I don't have. I've got a couple of projects I'm working on. There's about two or three of them that are in different form, but I haven't decided on which one yet. And the Turner project, I thought they did a nice job putting that together.
Are those other projects through acting or direct or both?
Yeah, both.
The role of Minerva and her spirituality becomes more central towards the end of the film. How did your own spirituality affect your portrayal of her in the film?
Well, I feel, I guess I feel very much like the Kevin Spacey character, Jim Williams character, when he says, I don't push much stock in it, but I do believe in it. That there's a spiritual force, and I don't know what I feel about it. I've never believed in voodoo, but it's always an interesting thing to delve into or listen to philosophies of. And Irma Hall, who plays Minerva, is interesting a character herself because she went into real study about. These kind of people, and I know that John's. I've never met the real Minerva, but both I know John Lee Hancock and John Barrett spent some time with. So there's a certain curiosity there, but I just had to kind of see it portrayed as it unraveled. But whether that has anything to do with my spirituality, no, I'm not a superstitious person.
I tried to. I didn't have to comment on Minerva. I tried to get Minerva together with Irma Hall. It just didn't work out. But amazingly, she really captured the sound of her voice. They never talked on the phone either. But I was struck by that. The getup was a little more ornate. The real Minerva wore the tight-fitting dress over her large self. But her personality and the voice is spookily the same. Very strange, and I don't know how she arrived at it, or how you all arrived at it, but it was very good, very good.
John, do you think you want to try some acting now?
No, definitely not. I didn't even do a walk on it.
Was that for the thought to have him in?
We would have welcomed him, but I think he preferred his status as the creator.
Gentlemen, the second one.
What do you like about acting, and what do you like about the acting? And if you ever have to tweak one of the two,
the first part again?
What do you like about acting, and what do you like about the acting? And if you ever have to tweak one, which one do you like?
Oh, I probably at this point, I like both. They're both very different. Directing, of course, you're involved with the whole ensemble, the whole project, and that's a lot of fun, and acting is a lot of fun too. It can be. I think probably directing is more satisfying down the line.
So address that requirement thing I tried to ask before. You answered it with a flat no. But are you getting your Social Security check now?
I'll give mine on to someone else, but I enjoy working, and I think I'm the type of person who would probably work forever. I enjoy free time also, but I don't want to have to do free time.
You regard yourself as an icon, and if so, or don't, why do you think work will start?
I have no idea. That's so subjective. After being around for 40 years, people think, well, he won't go away. I guess we'll call him something.
Are your best acting roles in films you've directed?
I think so. Ironically, I think I try to do my best with anybody, but. I think over the years I've done at least as good a work for myself as I have for other people.
Is one of your projects a golf club?
Yeah, I am fooling with that. We have a very well-known screenwriter is working on a golf project as we speak.
Are you saying golf or golf?
Golf. No, golf. Yeah, golf.
When you were...
I think Mr. Hancock is even eyeballing that one.
When you were a kid, did you ever allow yourself to dream that you'd be sitting here, grappling with the question of whether or not you were an icon?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, when you're a kid, you don't know, you have no idea what you're going at. At least I did. Well, everything is so related. When you're 15, you think 20 years old. And when you're 20, you think 30 years old. And it just goes on up down the line. So you don't ever figure you're going to I thought if I was lucky, I'd be. Who knows?
Was there a defining moment in your career, do you think?
No, I think the most defining moment, the first steady job I ever had in the acting profession was working on Rawhide. I probably thought at that point that this is miraculous. I've got to actually working at something I like to do and working week in, week out in the acting profession. I thought that was about as high as it's going to get.
Given your reputation, do you care at this point how well your movie opens? Are you above that, or do you worry about it more than ever?
I don't worry about it because when you once you've made the movie, you naturally have dreams for every movie. You don't want to make a film for an empty house. But at the same token, at some point you have to step aside and say that this no longer belongs to me. This is for the audience to either accept or reject. It's up to them, and that's there's nothing you can really do beyond that, other than just say, unless they'll either go to it or they won't. And that's with any movie. There's no way you can beat them up there if it's bad or it's not appealing in some way. And the plain reality is there's a lot of good movies that don't do business or do moderate business, and a lot of bad movies that do a lot of business. So it's really a crapshoot on that.
Michael, what's the biggest lesson you've learned in your career so far?
Patience.
Biggest regret.
Huh?
What's the biggest regret that you have had?
Well, you can't think in terms of regret. You always think, you could say, well, I could have done this or could have done that. But I'm a today person, and tomorrow to some degree, but you can't sit there and dwell on the past. There's a lot of things you could do differently. It's like you go back to childhood and say, well, I'd like to study this harder or something. But life is a constant lesson. You learn it, and sometimes very easily and sometimes not so easily.
We have time for one more question, please. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I was working with Kevin Spacey, and we look forward to working with him again.
Absolutely. He's an excellent actor, a very, very professional, comes very prepared with a lot of ideas. He did a lot of research. He did a lot of research on John's book and based upon John Lee's screenplay, and he went out and tried to learn as much as he could about his character, bringing a lot of good ideas about his character to the mix. Everybody did in this picture. That's what was so much fun. Some of the characters are composites, and a lot of imagination has to be used, but the Jim Williams character is not a composite. So he knew a lot about it.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.